Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Visionaries conceive of a future most of us can't imagine. And when it comes to transportation in one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S., vision is crucial. Beyond the annoyance factors we all face as we navigate our region, there are serious questions to address. How can we plan for a sustainable transit future? What is the impact of infrastructure spending, or the lack thereof? What national and international best practices can we look to? Will technology help solve our transportation problems? And how does the way we commute affect our health and happiness? The Seattle Department of Transportation, the Office of Arts and Culture, and KUOW have partnered on a series of talks with transportation experts. Where are we going? Seattle's transportation future. To address these questions, the first talk featured entrepreneur and transportation specialist Gabe Klein. Klein began his career working for Bikes USA before becoming a vice president for Zipcar in Washington, D.C. He went on to direct the departments of transportation in D.C. and Chicago. Gabe Klein spoke at the Seattle Public Library's Central Library on March 25, 2015. Thanks to Kevin Mitchum for our recording.
It is incredible that you are all here. This is an incredible turnout, and it says something about how important transportation is. And transportation is important because it is not just a transportation issue. Transportation is an environmental issue. How we choose to organize our transportation system directly affects our environment. In a state with fairly clean industries, the biggest source of carbon emissions in this state is actually transportation. Transportation is an issue of income inequality and social justice. If you are stuck in transportation and you need to pick up your child in traffic, or you can't get a bus that moves quickly, and you can't get your child from daycare on time, you will pay for that. If you work a job where you are paid for the hour and you're stuck in the transportation system, it will cost you. So when we talk about transportation, I think it's very, very important to think about it in an integrated way and not simply for those of us like me who just love transportation issues. You do, admit it. You love transportation issues. I have to tell you, during the time I chaired transportation in the legislature, I've worked on a lot of issues. Work on the entire healthcare system of the state or the entire educational system on the state. And people do not get as wound up and as personal as they do in transportation. Literally, whether it was someone who was retired, a junior high kid, someone who's an incredible neurosurgeon at UW, people come up to me with designs, literally, about how the transportation system can work. And there's a reason for that. While we do all need a healthcare system, and we do all need an education system, every single one of us walks out and uses a sidewalk, or gets on a bus, or drives a car, or rides a bike. That's why I think it's so incredibly connected to people and how they respond. The polling indicates that in this region, transportation, once again, is the number one issue. And I think it is for the reasons I said before. It's an issue of being able to move around. And as we grow as a city, we will not be able to handle that growth and preserve the way of life for those of us who grew up here and for those who moved here that we enjoy if we don't deal with our transportation system. So with that, I want to welcome our guest, Gabe. We all look forward to hearing you, and we really appreciate you coming out. But I want to introduce the next speaker, and that's a fairly still new director of the Seattle Department of Transportation. And when I went through the process of trying to select a director, I was curious about several things. I was curious about someone who actually understood transportation, not just from an engineering perspective, but understood how it worked on the ground. I was also interested in identifying somebody who understood the issues of equity. And when I pushed Scott Kubley on these issues. He actually came up with an example when I doubled down on the issue of race in transportation, since we know our system is very unequal when it comes to the issue of race and income. And he actually explained how he worked with African-American ministers along a main street in the south side of Chicago and was able to come up with a solution for a bike lane that they were opposed to. He talked about understanding the history of streetcars in the African-American community in Washington, D.C., which is a bad history because it symbolized something very different than what we think of when we think of streetcars, and was able to move that forward. And what that said to me is that I had found somebody who understood projects on the ground and understood equity. I also realized that he, you know, really liked to bike and run and hike and that you all would fall in love with him. So with that, it's my privilege to introduce Scott Kubley, the Director of Transportation for the City of Seattle.
So Mayor Murray's the fourth mayor that I've had the privilege to work for, and I don't think it's only because you hired me as your director that you're also my favorite mayor that I've had a chance to work for. You've demonstrated the ability to lead on really challenging issues, whether it's marriage equality or the minimum wage or getting a transportation package funded, hopefully getting a new levy funded. So it's really exciting to see that leadership here in Seattle. I, too, am amazed at the ability of Seattle to fill a room this big with transportation aficionados, so that's very exciting. I also want to recognize that we have our Secretary of Transportation here, Lynn Peterson, in the room, which is... which is very exciting as well. So we're at a really exciting time in transportation, and an exciting place to be to tackle some of those transportation challenges. And one of the things that, when I got here, I wanted to do was really bring international experts in to talk to Seattle about what's happening in the rest of the world. I think a lot of times, you know, when we get stuck in our day-to-day lives and, you know, we can look about this far out in front of our noses, and it's really refreshing to get a chance to see what other people are working on, how they're tackling challenges. And after nearly a half a century of doing transportation in one way and planning for one mode, We're at a time of great change, and it's happening really rapidly. There's been an explosion of new technologies. If you can think about how much the smartphone has changed transportation, if you can think about how Uber 5 years ago didn't exist and it's now a $40 billion company, times are changing. You can look at the shift in preferences. Goldman Sachs recently came out with a study that said 31% of millennials did not want to own a car. And they didn't want to own a car because it doesn't make economic sense if you're only going to use something 7% of the time. Climate change is also, I think, the issue of our time, and 40% of the emissions in the region are due to transportation, road transportation, and so we have a big role to play in that. Tonight, we're lucky to be partnering with KUOW on this event and all of the events, and we're going to have Kathy Desham as our moderator. Kathy is managing editor of KUOW Public Radio. And she came up through the ranks tackling transportation challenges. So I think, as a rule, I will take all salmon-related questions at the end of the event after everybody has had a chance to ask Gabe other questions. And she came up covering light rail, monorail, car sharing, and tonight she's gonna help us learn what we can take from other cities. Joining me on the stage afterwards and Gabe for a little Q&A is Michael Mattmiller. And Michael is our chief technology officer. And if you can imagine Uber is a $40 million company, you can also imagine why we need to have a really tight partnership with our head of IT, or our CTO. And we've done that just this past weekend with Hack the Commute. And last but not least, I want to introduce Gabe. Gabe was a pretty unconventional pick to run the District Department of Transportation back in 2008 when then Mayor Adrian Fenty selected him. He had been a Zipcar executive, he was the VP for the Mid-Atlantic region with Zipcar and helped bird the car sharing industry. He also owned or founded a boutique food truck company, and this was eight all-electric vehicles selling gourmet food, and this is before food trucks were food trucks. This is when food trucks were dirty water hot dogs. And so he was really at the forefront of innovation in the food industry. But then he came on to DDOT, and over the next 2 years, he launched bike sharing. He put two-way bike lanes down Pennsylvania Avenue between the White House and the Capitol. We launched streetcar plans, a next generation of parking infrastructure, and pay-by-phone. And then after that, he moved to Chicago to work for the Emanuel administration, and now he's worked and did a lot of the same stuff, but more. And now he's working in D.C. and consulting with multiple transportation startups and venture firms. And I had the pleasure of working with Gabe for about 5 years in D.C., a little bit in our off time, and then in Chicago, and a little bit in our off time after Chicago. And I can tell you it's completely accurate when he gets described as a next-generation change agent, a tech-minded entrepreneur, and having a passion for innovation. And what's funny is somebody that didn't come from the public sector actually probably taught me how to be the best public transit or transportation department director that I could actually be. So with that, I want to turn it over to Gabe to tell us a little bit about what he knows about transportation.
So listen, I thought I had an hour, but I actually have 30 minutes. So I've got way too many slides because there's so much going on in the world right now and too little time. So I'm going to take you on a little bit of a roller coaster ride instead of a presentation. And we're going to talk about sort of big picture, the issues that we're facing. We're going to talk about history and how that fits into where we are now. Talk about where we are now and why we need to really seize this moment that we have, not just in Seattle, but everywhere. And then what's coming and the implications. And that's the really interesting stuff, because as Scott said, 7 years ago, we were just getting the iPhone, and you look at how much has changed in 7 years. Well, it's going to change 2 to 3, 4, maybe 10 times as much over the next 5 years than what we see in the last seven. So with that, I'm going to jump right in. Bear with me. You know, big picture, we've got a problem. I was listening to this guy, David Christian, who's a brilliant climate scientist from the UK, and he really touched a nerve, because he basically said, look, we're here by accident, and we've been here 10,000 years, and if it wasn't for the dinosaurs and the Ice Age, there wouldn't even be an environment that was right for human beings to be here. And yet in the last 100 years since the Industrial Revolution, we have basically put a big dent in that environment towards destroying it. So we've got to be honest with ourselves about that. As the mayor said, transportation accounts for over a third of greenhouse gases. I guess it's more than that here. And let's face it, not everybody believes or outwardly projects that there is really an issue. I was on the airplane here, and I had internet, and I picked this up, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. But then I remembered 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, the congressman with the snowball, I don't know if people saw that, and he was throwing it, and he said, look, there's snow. There's no climate change. So that's the level of sophistication and populism that we're dealing with out there. But here's the good news, and this is why the private sector is important in this debate. Sometimes, actually, my wife works for the EPA, and they did a study, she told me loosely about it, where they tried to figure out how they could get across to people that climate change was real and how urgent it was. And basically the study was like, yeah, you probably won't be able to do that because the result. Because people don't understand something of that magnitude bearing down on them. It's just hard for us to comprehend. But we can understand when it's affecting our pocketbook. And it's starting to affect corporations' pocketbooks, whether you're an orange grower or an energy tycoon, I guess. So let's talk about traffic fatalities, because this is a big, big issue. And culturally in this country, we have a certain acceptance, of the 32,000 people a year that die. And 50% of those people are our most vulnerable users. Children, elderly people, disabled people. And internationally, it's an even bigger issue. It's the number one killer of people 10 to 19, and also people 15 to 29. There's also 20 to 50 million people that sustain non-fatal injuries. They may lose a leg or a foot. But these are serious issues that we have to deal with. And then you've got the health effects of all of our vehicles. Type 1 diabetes is actually the most common chronic illness in children and youth, and there's like 65,000 new cases diagnosed each year. Now let's talk a little bit about, I'm going to jump into history. We, as human beings, we tend to think a lot about what we've seen in our lifetime. And most of us in this room are probably somewhere between 25 and 75, I'm guessing. And so we may not remember what Seattle and other cities looked like before the automobiles were really prevalent. And in 1900, there were a few thousand automobiles. And by 1930, there were like 28 million. So we think about all the change that's going on now with the cloud revolution, the internet revolution, the internet age. Well, they went through it back then as well. This is, I found this online. This is Bainbridge Island in the late 1800s. I thought it must be England with the cop's uniform. But do you guys remember when you were young and kids rode bikes to school? In the late 60s, two-thirds of kids walked or biked to school. Now we're down to one-third, and only 1% of that one-third, I guess that's the right term, actually bike. People don't want their kids to bike, not particularly in a city where cars own the streets. So here's the, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Aegis building, A-E-G-I-S. This is congestion, but as my friend John Norquist, who is the head of the Congress for New Urbanism, would say, this is good congestion. Congestion is not bad. It's just bad if it's bumper-to-bumper traffic emitting fumes and not moving many people. People filling your streets, commerce, streetcars, these are good things. These are things that we want. Now, we tend to think that we're really innovative. I love this slide. This is my favorite slide. We had electric vehicles back in 1900. This is an electric taxi cab. We had 300 of them in New York City. They went 25 miles in a charge, and they went 25 miles per hour. And around the turn of this century, we basically reinvented the same thing that we had 100 years ago. These things all burned up mysteriously in a warehouse, and they went away. The bike. The bike is not a new thing. It's been an uphill battle to bring it back, no pun intended, right here. It has been tough. People started to look at the bike as something recreational. It's actually the number two recreational activity in the United States. There's about $82 billion worth of commerce around bikes and bike travel and such. To give you a sense of how big that is, the airline industry is $52 billion, so it's big. But people associate bikes with recreation, not with basic utilitarian transportation. So, you know, it wasn't all bright spots back then. Some of you might recognize where this is. And we had shanty towns back then. We had shanty towns in D.C., where I'm from, right next to the Capitol. So cities have also moved in a good direction. And some places haven't changed that much, right? So let's go through quickly a little bit of history that tells you about how we got to where we are with the car as king. The Federal Highway Act came around under Eisenhower, and the idea was to build a interstate network for transportation, mostly for goods, but also so people could freely travel from city to city and state to state. It was an admirable idea. But very quickly, we took it too far, and we thought, oh, it's so great, it's so efficient. Let's just plow right through our cities, tear the heart and soul out of our cities, segregate our neighborhoods by building expressways through our cities. And people came back from the war, and there was a lot of suburban, you know, the dawn of suburbia and tract housing. People were making about $3,200 a year. And by the way, these were not big houses. They were like 700 square foot houses, these suburban houses. But when we moved everybody out to the suburbs, then there are other ramifications, which we saw quickly. Now in Europe, it's interesting. They had a realization much earlier than we did about the effects of the choices that they had made. And, well, we didn't really. For a brief moment, we thought, oh, maybe the bicycle is going to be our salvation. But that was not going to come to be for at least another 40 years. And so here we are. So when you go to Amsterdam and Copenhagen and you go to London now, it feels very different than it does here. But we're dealing with the land use and the choices that we've made. And now it's very hard to change that. So Let's talk about what's happening now. First of all, around the turn of this century, we really started to make a switch. When people started to move back to cities and buy houses in cities, they realized there was a cost. Like when I was at Zipcar, we really tried to educate people that if you spend $900 a month on a car, then that's money you can't, that's $100,000 a house you can't afford. So we've really gone from a century of massive consumption, particularly after World War II, to a new century that's really, it's more experiential. Younger people are not as focused on owning stuff. It's just not as interesting to them. And even our mayors are realizing that there's a whole economy in this, particularly as our workforce goes from being a very full-time focused workforce to more of a fractional workforce. We've doubled part-time employment since 2007. And there's new business models in the sharing economy. There's co-working spaces. There were like none when I left DC and went to Chicago. Now there were 12 last year, now there's almost 20 in DC. Airbnb, I have a former employee that actually worked at DDOT that was able to quit her job that she didn't like. She didn't like working for me. No, I'm kidding. Because she was able to sell the extra room or rent the extra rooms in her house through Airbnb. And between that and the Affordable Care Act, she was able to leave and start consulting, and now she's in a career that she really likes. Also, people have realized the true cost of car ownership. They didn't when gas was $1.28 a gallon and housing was really cheap. But now they do, and younger people do. And people are driving less anyway, because cities are revitalizing. You've got a grocery store in your neighborhood, your school is in your neighborhood, your doctor's in your neighborhood. So you have these new types of services, like Lyft, like Uber, like Sidecar. Love them or hate them, they are providing a service for people. And people are starting to share, you know, just about everything. In fact, wedding dress sharing is a big thing right now. Purse sharing is a big thing right now. And I think that the next big thing will be peer-to-peer networks. I mean, why should Uber control the ride-sharing business when any car should have the capability of being able to flip on ride-sharing, and maybe the car company or whoever's running that network charges a quarter instead of 30% of the fare? So true peer-to-peer networks will actually disrupt, I think, a lot of these businesses like Uber that are really making a tremendous margin and not necessarily doing that much. And it's not just the private sector that's doing great things with sharing. Bike sharing is a great example. And you know, Scott and I had the opportunity to bring the first large-scale bike sharing system to the U.S. with Capital Bike Share and then Divvy in Chicago. But it shows that the government can do a great job, particularly in partnership with the private sector, to bring transportation options to people. And it's everywhere. And this is an old list from like a year ago. But look, it's in Fort Worth, Texas. I mean, that's pretty awesome. I love when people tell me that I can't do things. I think Scott's the same way. And I was told that nobody would ever wear a suit on a bike share bike. It's ridiculous, preposterous. Well, come to downtown Chicago or downtown DC, and I'm sure it's like this here, you see suits everywhere on bikes because it's the fastest, cheapest, most practical way to get around the city. When we launched Divvy, we didn't even put bike share in the name because people understood that it was bike share. And of course, you guys have Pronto. And Pronto is, I love that color, by the way. I think it's a beautiful system. I just think it should be bigger. Bigger in nodal systems is better. So Divvy started with 300 stations, and it's going up to, I think, 550 in the next year. 575, sorry, I was wrong. And there are ways for the public to play really active roles in picking out where the stations go, even picking the name like we did in Washington, D.C. And all the technology is not just on your phone. I mean, the availability of, you know, modular design, solar power is getting so much better. That's made biking for people so much easier. And it's made biking a service, a fractional type service, versus having to even own a bike. Although I have like 7 bikes and I use bike share. That's another problem. That's another issue. And government can do a much better job with marketing. You know, we've learned that. We contracted with IDEO, who designed the first Apple mouse and does incredible design and branding work, to do the work on Divi. And even I was sort of questioning, like, wow, this is, like, really intense. We'd have these sessions. We had to drink a lot of beer. We had to, like, throw a lot of stuff at the wall. It was worth it. Chicagoans love Divi. They feel like it's their system. So the other great thing about bike sharing is people have had this awakening, like, wait, so I drive to work. I drive to work. I come home. Then I drive to the gym. I take the escalator down. And then I run the treadmill for 30 minutes. And they're realizing, wait a second, I guess I could just ride to work. But again, we have this cultural issue. We think you can't wear heels, you can't wear a skirt, you can't wear a suit, you can't do this. Can't have any sweat on your person when you get to work, right? Baloney. And again, looking back, this is 1895, right outside of Seattle. If they can do it, we can do it. So, what else is going on right now? Well, in many places, we've lost our streetcars. We've lost other facilities. And so if you look at that space, you can repurpose it. And what we did in Washington with the Pennsylvania Ave bike lane is we took this sort of non-traditional view of what a bike lane should be. And we looked at where the streetcar used to go. And we said, well, wait a second, why can't that be a bike lane? And I think it's a wonderful bike lane. I think you have a great line of sight from the Capitol to the White House. And it does also make a statement nationally that bike lanes are for everybody. I should have the picture, actually, of the president and Michelle Obama walking on it. And so when we got to Chicago, we knew that, you know, the first thing we had to do was attack the downtown. And actually, Scott and others worked on the Bike 2020 plan, which called for 645 miles of facilities in Chicago, and to have a high-quality bike facility within a half mile of every Chicagoan, per the mayor. And the Dearborn two-way protected bike lane took excess capacity that was not being used. We put in dedicated turn lanes, dedicated signals for cyclists, and guess what? Throughput stayed the same for automobiles, and people actually started biking downtown again. So it was well worth the effort. We also, I think we only spent $1 million on the entire project. So the ROI, which is all I care about, I don't care how much a project costs. It could be a $1 trillion project or a $1 million project. All I care about is the return on investment. And the return on investment on projects like this, on a bike project or a safety project, depending on how you look at it, is very high. And now there's really a movement nationally to put in protected bike facility networks in cities. And in Europe, when you go over there, well, they're already one-upping us. They're building bicycle superhighways, like in the Netherlands, between all of their cities. People are riding 30, 40 miles between cities. The other nice thing about this is as we get more regular people on bikes, meaning not just young, white, male, fixie riders, which is what happens when you don't have many bike lanes and you don't have bike share, there's this realization, like they have in Europe, like, you know, maybe we do need separate facilities. Maybe it's not fun. Maybe it's not fun riding next to, you know, a 3,000, 4,000-pound vehicle going 60 miles an hour. So car drivers are getting more respectful and they're understanding more. I can tell you in D.C., traffic calming, it's a night and day difference from 20 years ago when I came to D.C. And yes, automated enforcement's played a big part, but I would say more people walking and biking has probably had the biggest impact. We're also doing other innovative things with our streets all over the country. The Make Way for People program, which Janet Attarian ran in Chicago, aimed to take excess capacity and space on the street or just convert a parking space and to make it work for people again. And I was telling, I don't have a lot of time, but I'll try to very quickly tell this story. I was telling staff at SDOT earlier that we got to a point where we could have just said, we're just not going to do this because, you know, we sold our parking meters before we got there. Daily sold the parking meters for $1.2 billion, or long-term lease. So every space that we took, we had to pay like $28,000. So normally when you get to that point, you just say, okay, forget it, next. And instead, we put our minds to it and realized, well, wait, if we could find some unregulated space nearby and we can turn that into a metered space, then guess what? Because these are only up 6 months out of the year because it's so cold in Chicago, you got to take it down. So what we ended up doing was for every space we took for one of these, we found a space that gets 365 days a year worth of revenue, and we then put this space back into revenue for 6 months out of the year. So for every Make Way for People spot, the city gets 50% more revenue. And there's always a win-win-win like that if people, public, private, citizens, put their minds to it and get creative. What else is going on? NACTO, which is the North American City Transportation Officials, I probably got that wrong, and I'm on the board. National Association of City Transportation Officials, I always get that wrong, is doing really, really important work. Urban design guidelines, bikeway design guidelines. When I was a fellow at the Urban Land Institute, we even adopted the urban street design guide, which is important because all the richest developers worldwide are part of ULI, so it socializes this. So why did ULI do that? They did it because it makes money, because these things are good for our economy. Just like all the things that will save our planet will also generate income if we can get off fossil fuels. So it's interesting, though, ULI also did this infrastructure survey, and they surveyed public and private and said, you know, what are we doing well? What are we not doing well? You know, what are the key drivers? Where are real estate investors going to put money around infrastructure? And the thing that I pulled out of the report that I thought was interesting is the perceptions of infrastructure quality. So we know that you get a really high return. You actually don't get it from building roads, even bridges. You get it from transit, bike projects, PED projects, public space projects. But guess what? We all can agree, public and private, that we're doing a pretty crappy job there. We're not spending enough money. Now, let's take that highways up. Okay. So, Americans, because, again, we live in the last 50, 60, 70 years that we've been on the planet, we don't understand necessarily that that bridge is 100 years old, but it's going to fall down if we don't reinvest in it. We also don't understand that some of those bridges are 50 million, 100 million. We built a bridge in D.C., bridges, it was 365 million. So people don't understand that. And they also don't understand that there's a difference between spending and investing. I would argue that the $3 trillion we spent in Iraq was spending. I would argue that building, instead of building bridges in Baghdad, if we build infrastructure here, that's an investment in our future. We spend 2 to 3% of our GDP. Thank you. I knew it was a friendly crowd. The U.S. spends 2 to 3% of GDP on infrastructure. Europe spends 5 to 6%. And when you go there, you can see it. You see it on the street. And Asia is spending 8 to 9%. And their GDP is pretty healthy. So, we're not spending enough. And we're not spending it on the right things when we do spend it. So, here's one great thing that NACTO did, too, with New York, is they really dug into, you know, is this good for business? Oh, it is. And it's good for safety? Okay, so why aren't we doing more of this? And people want it once they see it. Now, it takes a little bit of courage. You got to get out there and do some of this innovative stuff, reclaim some of the streets, as Jeanette did in New York, and we've done in D.C., and you guys have done in Seattle. The first ones are hard. Then it gets easier. But the thing is, from an economic standpoint, the states and cities that are safe are going to be the places that people want to raise families, the place that the millennials want to go, right? So you guys are doing a good job. Not quite as good as D.C., but that's not a fair comparison because D.C. is a very, very urban place. So why now? Why is this such an important point in time? So I started speaking after I left, like the end of 2013, and I had this slide, Elon Musk, this is like from March of last year, Elon Musk said, we're going to have self-driving car technology, not really the cars, in 3 years. Then last summer he said, oh, actually it's going to be 2016. And then he announced last week, actually we're just going to download it to the cars now, and it's going to... So, like, June? How does June work for everybody? And I was in a NACTO meeting because I'm my function on the board, or the way I see it, is to focus on technology for the future. And Jeanette's been working on the global design guidelines. We have got to sort of get our act together on this stuff as cities, because we have this opportunity. If there's 90% fewer cars, there's a lot of space that frees up to do other things with, entire streets that we could close potentially. So here's the issue. We are still thinking in today's terms. We're thinking in linear terms, and things have totally gone exponential, and we just don't realize it yet. If you're in Silicon Valley, you realize it. But for the rest of us, actually, you guys probably realize it more than we do in DC. So I will admit this is a very old thing from like 1982, but I believe this is the issue. You know, Moore's Law says that computing power doubles every 18 months. And Moore was the guy who founded Intel. And it's been proven true for the last 38 years. So can the government and can the citizenry and can the NGOs and the private sector come together and, you know, sort of get our act together and make sure that the change that comes is good for people? What's fascinating is that people are starting to realize that maybe, particularly level, so I'm not going to bore you and I don't have time to go through level 1, 2, 3, and 4 autonomous technology, but level 3 autonomous technology is a little scary, actually, where you can turn it on and off on your own, be sort of lulled into thinking it's working and then, you know, fall asleep or whatever. So I think there will come a time where people like Scott and Lynn and others have an opportunity to say, you know what, at the city limits, you got to have it in autonomous mode. You can't drive in the city anymore. And I think that's coming. So, you know, back to road deaths. I thought this was interesting. I was looking at this. You know, just in Canada, through different policies, they have half the road deaths that we do. They're just over the border. But look at that. And I didn't go into like any great, like I didn't really study this to figure it out. But it's not all technology. You know, we need to re-engineer our streets. We got to educate people. We got to have much better enforcement. If you kill somebody and you're drunk, you should go to jail for the rest of your life. I mean, these things need to change. And we hear so much about modal conflict. Oh, those damn pedestrians crossing when they aren't supposed to, and the cyclists jumping in front of me, and so on. We've had that. We've had that for years. It's nothing new. We need to get over that. But, you know, I think we need to be prepared for the modes of the future. And they are going to be different. There's pedal electric trikes. I have one of these. It's really fun. Solar powered, goes 93 miles on a charge. You don't have to actually plug it in. And you get exercise. I was in Portland. They have these pedal electric frozen food distributor vehicles that are amazing. I know there's competition between Seattle and Portland, so I'm sorry, but I had to show this. There's new business models like Bridge. This is a company that I advise that's looking at flexible mass transit, something between a bus and a car, like a Sprinter van with 13 seats, that actually moves depending on what the demand is. You know, when we got rid of the streetcars and we got the bus, the promise was that you'd get flexibility. But we never got that flexibility. We got the bus running in the same route the streetcar did, but we got rid of the streetcar because the streetcar didn't generate enough revenue for the companies that produce equipment and rubber and all of those things. We've got very interesting carpooling services being introduced as part of the TNC model. And you may see it come as part of the taxi model at some point. I don't believe this is true, but I do think we need to make the local bus better. You know, we have the local bus because we want to have an equitable transportation option for people. I don't think running in some places every 40 minutes is equitable. I think we need to do better. And in DC, I've been working to help stand up this co-op, which is really exciting, to unite all 119 taxi companies and 7,000 cabs under one virtual umbrella so they can compete with the TNCs. And they actually will have handicapped accessible vehicles and all of this stuff. And even the president got pitched on this, and he was like, go forth and save the taxi industry. They need your help. So, now the fun part, and I've got like 2 minutes, but I'm going to go over. So, how do we get where we need to go at this point in time? And this is a super exciting, like this is the most exciting time to work in transportation in the last 100 years. I'm sure it was really exciting 100 years ago too. So first of all, people like me and Lynn and Scott and all the people that have these jobs, we've got to have a different attitude, and luckily we do. You know, it's not about selling people on transportation. Transportation, as the mayor said, affects people's quality of life in so many different ways. And it's really about educating people about that and talking to them about the feature, the advantage, and benefit of what we're doing, not boring them with transpo wonk talk. You guys will get that from me, but you obviously appreciate it. And it's about having tight plans. One of the things that we did in DC and Chicago is we had 2-year aggressive, metrics-driven plans. And again, they were around quality of life issues. And now you guys have your plan, and I would encourage people to get behind and support it. And you need a long-term plan, and you need short-term milestones to hit. And I know that you can do it. And in Chicago, we put a lot of plans in place. Some people would say too many. But they're important, and we also adopted Vision Zero in 2012 as part of our Complete Streets Chicago plan, knowing full well that technology and automated enforcement, but also in terms of the technology that's coming with autonomous and vehicle-to-vehicle communication would help us to get there. The other thing is we've got to start redesigning around people again and stop being so focused on mode, regardless of what the mode is. And, you know, one of the things we did, which was controversial even with cyclists or transit users until we explained it to them, is to prioritize the pedestrian first. The pedestrian as the indicator species of a healthy city. The pedestrian, who's also a transit user, who's also a driver and also a cyclist, but pedestrian first. And also, if you plan for your pedestrians that are, you know, young, old, and disabled, you'll be okay with everybody else. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but you will. So plan for people. Also, there's great adaptive reuse projects. And I'm just going to fly through these pictures because we don't have time. But we took an abandoned rail line that the mayor wanted to turn into a trail, and we figured out the plan and the money in about 8 to 10 months, went to construction in about a year, and I think it'll be done in the next few months. It's just a little behind, but it'll be done. Another project we undertook, Scott did a lot of work on this, the Chicago Riverwalk. This was literally a conceptual design, not even a design, it was a concept when we came in and took office, and the chief engineer and the person, Michelle, who ran our, you know, all of our harbor master type stuff. I found out I was the harbor master. I didn't even know when I took the job. They had dreamt this up, and it seemed like a crazy idea, like reinventing 8 blocks of Riverwalk with no budget. But, you know, I went down there, I walked down there, and they were selling dollar beers on the Riverwalk. And this is on Wacker Drive, this is right in the heart, like next to State Street where there's $8 lattes around the corner, because you couldn't even see there was anything down there. So we put together a plan over the course of a year. We sold it to the mayor at the last possible moment before we were meeting with Secretary LaHood. He loved it. The budget office didn't. Some other people didn't. But the mayor loved it. And then we went to work figuring out how to pay for it. And Scott and Michelle figured out that we could rebid the 3 tour boat slips that we had for the architecture tours and pay for about 75% of the project. And I wish I could go into more detail because it's really a great story. But look at this. This is horrible. And we're making it beautiful. And this has gone from conception to reality in literally 4 years. This is a mega project in the middle of downtown Chicago, and it's almost done. So when people tell you that you can't do stuff, I argue that you can if you put your mind to it. And we could have stopped when we realized that we don't have $100 million. But they had just announced the TIFIA program to the tune of $17 billion. We knew we could get a loan for 35 years at the overnight treasury rate, like 3.2%. Scott figured out we could rebid the Torbo fees. We have a little bit of retail space. And basically, the people of Chicago get an investment that will pay dividends forever, and the taxes that come from that are amazing, for free. For the private sector, coughing up a little bit more. And the other beauty of that project is that it shows that if you align the incentives of the public sector and the private sector, you can accomplish a tremendous amount. But it takes like actually sitting down with the private sector and figuring that out. And often government doesn't do that. So real quick, you guys are an emerging mega region. Congratulations. And we got to connect our mega regions. And so I do believe high-speed rail is going to come. It's interesting, you know, the West Coast is finally making progress with a government-funded option. And then Florida is a very interesting project where, you know, the governor turned back the money. So real quick, the Flaglers are the people that built the original East Coast Railroad in Florida in the 1880s. And they're now real estate moguls. They're selling all of their real estate, and they're rebuilding high-speed rail, and then they're going to capitalize on all the real estate around the nodes. Isn't that interesting? Again, what's old is new. Now, with all this new technology, look, there's going to be interests that come out, insurance companies and others that say, this is bad stuff. I encourage people to listen to themselves and read up on this, because it's not. We are the unsafe ones. We are distracted, we drink and then drive, not we in this room, but you know, people do stupid things. They drop coffee on their lap and then they run over somebody. That won't happen. That won't happen with a computer. And the other thing is we have this huge opportunity, as I was saying earlier. We can retake our streets, and quickly. This is going to happen quickly. So people say, yeah, but you know what, the public doesn't trust these computer cars, these robo-cars. Actually, that's not true. Without ever having seen one, this is from 2013, and you know, 2 years is like an eternity. People are like, yeah, I actually think I would ride one. Plus, I actually think I would trust it for my kid as much as me driving. And then when you pair it with vehicle-to-vehicle technology, which means that the cars can talk to each other and ride literally 2 to 3 inches apart, because the car in the front, when it gets ready to slow down, it's already told the car in the back. It's a total game changer. And then we have to also almost rethink, what is transit at that point? What does transit look like in that future? And then, of course, you have Google, who is building a city car. You remember I was talking about my NEVs and LSVs, or I think I was talking about those little 25-mile-per-hour vehicles? That's what this is. It's got a foam bumper. So if it bumps into a pedestrian, they bump off of it. it's got no steering wheel, and it's basically a robo-taxi. Now, the good news is the car companies are actually, they're building technology in gradually as they have it. So Ford has obstacle avoidance technology built into a lot of their cars for 2015. Volvo's doing some amazing stuff with cyclist avoidance and ped avoidance. And in Europe, they're really even marketing it. And you can get the cyclist avoidance option on your car. But back to our cities, think if we need 85 to 90% fewer cars in the city, what that means for our right-of-way, which means streets. Completely different. The parking can basically go away. Now, there are other issues, too. We've got freight, right? We've got freight that has to come to our city. We've got loads of salmon that have to come in to the city. But let's use that load of salmon as an example. I actually don't know enough about it to know why it flipped over or anything. But, you know, in Europe, they're moving to a model, and we've now followed suit. Actually, let me jump ahead. I saw these trucks, actually, over in Europe, and they parked the truck at the end of town. The truck just sets up, and then they have these little pedal electric trikes that run packages into the city. And when the trucks do come in, I was in Deventer in the Netherlands, where the whole downtown is closed. It's only pedestrians. No bikes allowed. You get outside of the immediate downtown, then bikes and pedestrians. You get outside of that, it's farmland. You can do anything you want. And they even have bike lanes in farmland there. But they deliver everything at night. So you have to have all your deliveries in by like 6 or 7 a.m. So now, whoops, I'm jumping around too much. So we're looking at finally doing that now. So if the salmon truck came in at 3 in the morning, then maybe it wouldn't have had a conflict and maybe it wouldn't have flipped over. Maybe. In terms of parking, again, the private sector is a little bit ahead. They're already realizing, like, you know what? This stuff's going away, and guess what? We could make a lot more money using it for something else. There are actually people out there trying to think, could they do an Airbnb in the parking space at night? I know, but it's true. And people are looking at converting their garage space. I'm actually doing this on my house if the Board of Zoning Adjustments will allow me to convert my garage into a unit. And you've got micro units popping up all over. So land use is a big part of the transportation problem. And the history that we went over earlier, where we built all these, you know, this tract housing out in the suburbs. So micro units are popping up. We got three projects, or four projects now in DC. This is a real photograph. These are modular units that they build and they crane in. Here's one in San Francisco. It's like IKEA. You buy it, and they slide it right in, they click it in, and there you go. Why not? So what are some of the ramifications of this? Well, we do have poverty moving out of cities. Cities are getting to be very expensive. It's a really tough question what to do. And that's a longer conversation we can have here. There's the one-third set aside for lower-income people, which I personally like. But you know what? There are suburbs that are urbanizing, too. And I think that we had 2 billion people in some of those pictures I was showing you from 1900. We had 2 billion people. Now we have 5 billion. We're going to have like 7 to 9 billion in the next 20 years, 30 years. So we're going to have to urbanize. And these are the people that are going to be running things. And this is where they want to live. And the new business models that are coming to the fore are going to be a big part of the solution. So we got to figure out a way to work together better. And again, I think if we can align our incentives, if we could have a do-over with the TNCs, you know, with the Lyfts and the Ubers, and sort of get more from them to allow them into our city, well, we need to do that with autonomous vehicles, which we are going to do. And NACTA is doing great work on that. And then I think we will get to a place, like Europe's already said, their downtowns are going car-free by 2050. I don't know that we'll be car-free. I think we'll be driver car-free, and we'll have streets that there aren't any cars on. And we have to remember, too, that it's not just about stuff and technology. It's about information. And I know that Scott just did a launch for having, you know, like getting transit screens out in the public way so that people actually know what the options are. Government doesn't do a great job always of getting people information. So that's important, too. And really, this is what it comes down to. And this is why Uber and Lyft are doing so well, right? And now you got Apple that's building a car. I was in a meeting with a major car company, and that day we found out that, and it was about this stuff, we found out that Uber was building their own car and Apple was going to build their own car. And that Google was creating an app to get into the Uber business, all in a 24-hour period. That's how fast things are changing. And now, after NACTO and others have said to Google, hey, we don't think you should sell those cars to people. We think maybe they should be shared vehicles. Google announced in November that they're going to sell them just into shared fleets instead of selling them to people. So that's how, like, we can work with technology companies to make change. And at the end of the day, it really comes down to simple things, like, where do you want to live? Nobody wants to live there. That real estate is dead. And it's really about quality of life and people. This is me. I just had a daughter, and this is her new bike, because I only have 7 bikes. This is hers. But my goal, and I always tell people this, my goal, she's 10 months last week, my goal is when she is 8 years old that she can walk to school on her own or bike to school without fear of getting hit or being abducted or any of those things via technology and some of the changes that we're making to re-engineer our streets and make them safer. Because remember, at the end of the day, it's really about that. I really do believe that it's about that. And Seattle is a wonderful, livable, awesome place. It's on the right track. So when we think about the future for all of us, you know, we have this opportunity. This, I think, would be a real failure if this is where we ended up, with pedestrians being relegated to tunnels and cars moving, you know, extremely fast around our city and cities just moving people. Or we could create places with streetcars and bike lanes and autonomous pods and so on and so forth. Thank you so much for listening. I'm only a couple minutes over. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Gabe, so much. And the way we're going to work this now is we're going to have Scott Kubley come up, and also Michael Matt Miller, who's the CTO of the City of Seattle. And I'll reintroduce myself. I'm Kathy Duchamp from KUOW. And I have lots of questions, and you guys probably have questions for Gabe as well. As far as audience questions, we're going to have a mic over here and a mic over there. So if you have burning questions in your belly, you know, write them down and get ready. But Gabe, I have a question for you to kind of kick things off, and I've seen you make this observation before that transportation planning and kind of future visioning is a lot about managing change. Mm-hmm. And a lot about managing change involves changing people's behavior. So how do you change people's behavior, especially when it comes to driving?
Yeah. Well, I wrote I actually have a mic. Thank you.
Okay.
I wrote a little piece for City Lab last year, which is the Atlantic's cities magazine online. And I think we titled it Carrots and Sticks. And I actually used the parking reform we did in D.C., where we extended the hours from like 6:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m., which is a big deal, like you're charging people at night. But our downtown had changed from a 8-hour-a-day place to a 18-hour-a-day place, and we wanted more turnover. And so, to make a long story short, by giving people so much more convenience, by giving them brand new meters that worked for very low cost, they paid for themselves in 90 days because we actually made more money. By integrating pay by phone into the system, because people were so used to getting tickets because the meters never worked, we basically got rid of that problem. So we used carrots to make the stick more palatable. Is that right? We didn't need to use a stick, I guess, because we gave some carrots, something like that. I'm sorry. But the point is, like, if you're going to say you can't do this, then give somebody a great option to move to, and then it's a different bargain that you're driving with them, I think.
About making choices or offering people choices. Yeah. You talked about making change requiring courage, and you're such a good storyteller. I wonder if you could give us an example of something that took courage, either in D.C. or Chicago, a project that you worked on.
God, there's a bunch. The Pennsylvania Ave bike lanes were definitely, they were high risk. And to be honest, we screwed them up. We made some mistakes, I think, in the engineering of them. And I sort of took my eye off the ball. And there was a little bit of a disagreement between me and some other people and some people in the agency as to how they should roll out. So they actually rolled out incorrectly. And that was really stressful. But I actually would give the mayor credit for being really courageous because he had my back on it. And I even threw like a little temper tantrum. No, you know, this is okay. He had my back. He let me screw it up. He let me fix it. And then we had a huge celebration and a great ribbon cutting. And I think that's important to let people make mistakes, like your own staff, almost to encourage them to make mistakes, because that's the only way that you learn. And if people don't feel like they can make mistakes, then they're going to be really rigid in their thinking. I don't know if that really answers your question, but.
Mm-hmm. What about, Seattle's about to do something pretty courageous in that we're asking voters to consider a levy that's more expensive than one we've had before. It'll cost somebody who owns a $450,000 home about $275 a year. How do we sell that?
There's a lot of ways to sell it. I mean, educating people on how much we're spending now and that things are crumbling is one way. I think it's better, though, to if you show people you're going to be spending $275, but you're probably the value of your home's going to go up $700 a year as a result, then it's like, that's not really, like, that's an investment, right? So I think it's like how you market it to people and how you position it. And people's reaction can be a complete 180 depending on how you sell it to them. You can sell it to them by saying that your kids are going to be safer, by showing them what type of infrastructure you're going to build. I mean, obviously there's some big ticket items that Scott and Lynn, you know, have to build. I mean, big bridges that nobody really gets excited about necessarily, but they have to be done. But then you allocate X percentage of money to things that people see in their neighborhoods. And you explain how much safer things are going to be. You layer on the fact that their real estate's going to go up in value and blah, blah, blah. And then sort of like, well, what's $275?
Mm-hmm. And have you had experience? Have you had experience trying to sell a big transportation levy in either D.C. and Chicago? And what was that like?
I don't know if I had experience selling, I mean, like a big levy for the entire system, but definitely big individual projects. Like the 11th Street Bridge in D.C. was, you know, one set of bridges. It was a $450 million project. And through a design build, we got it down to $365. It was the first design build project that the city had ever done. There was a lot of stress within the government about whether we could handle it or not. It went extremely well. It came in early and under budget, and we managed it really well. So I think you have to sell it to people like you would sell, like the private sector would sell anything to people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When we were sitting in the audience, hey, what's your last name?
Campbell.
Campbell.
Is this one?
Okay, thank you. So Kay Campbell from the city of SeaTac is here with us, and we were, when you were kind of laying out the vision for, you know, maybe someday Lynn and Scott will say, well, hey, maybe we'll just basically say, you know, inside the city limits, you can't drive. She said, it reminds me of the Wild West, you know, park your guns.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a great vision.
That sounds
good,
too.
Park your guns at the edge of town. That's a really good one. But how, you know, if you were to get out your crystal ball, I mean, what timeline would you put on that happening in Seattle or another American city?
Well, first of all, you know, we lose 32,000 people a year in the U.S. to road death, and then we lose another 32,000, I think, to gun deaths. So I think parking all that outside of the city actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's thank you. It's more people than we lose to any war that we're fighting anywhere around the globe. So it is a war, and I think we need to think of it that way. And I think the technology is actually going to speed this up so much, because I think when we get to that level three where people can turn it on and off, I think Elon Musk is right. He's a brilliant guy, and I think he's right that when that happens, and we're talking about a few years, then cities are going to have to make a decision about whether they want that in their city or they want just autonomous in their city. And, you know, when everything's going to be autonomous, that I don't know, because we have so many cars in our system. I think there's a billion cars in the system. So you got to filter them out. But I think what'll happen is when one city does it, you know, just like Seattle adopted the $15 minimum wage, watch how many other cities do it. You know, we did bike sharing in D.C., and now there's like 25 cities in the U.S. with bike sharing. Quickly. That was 2010. So the first city that says, you know what, we don't want cars in our city anymore because we want zero deaths, or we don't want people driving them, then I think it'll happen quickly. And it depends on the private sector, the public sector, one city stepping up. I don't know, 10 years?
Wow, what do you think? Cool. I have two more questions, and then we'll take some from the audience. So if you guys have questions, want to start queuing up, now's the time. And this first one is for both you and Scott. So there's this thing called the Seattle process. Have you heard about that?
No, it sounds scary.
Yeah, I did. I did a story for NPR on the Seattle process back in our early days of light rail, being that we love our city so much. Everybody wants a say in things.
Mm.
So it takes a while to get things done. So I'm wondering if you could tell us about your experience with process in other cities, and then also have Scott make some observations on him, on yourself as a newcomer to Seattle and experiencing it.
I think you have to be incredibly inclusive. I think you got to listen to everybody, and you have to go to every corner of your city and listen to everybody. But I do think sometimes you have to make, if you know more about what's happening than some of the people in some of the communities, like, you can't make every decision by a vote, okay? Because if we do that, we will be staring down the barrel of a gun on the climate change issue. Like, people have to step up. So, you know, it, like, if we had just left it to a vote, I don't know if we'd have 100 miles of bike lanes in Chicago, you know? We never voted on the bike share program. I mean, I think process is important. Like, the public decides where they go with us, right? What's the color? What's the name? But they don't decide, like, if we're going to do it. So, I don't know. But I've worked in two strong mayor systems, and I don't know much about Seattle's former government. And culturally, different cities can be like 180s, you know?
Scott.
So they are like 180s. I would say Chicago, you know, Seattle's a strong mayor system as well, but Chicago, I would argue, sort of has almost that unitary executive philosophy towards the mayorality going back 50, 60 years. I think the thing that I've observed about the Seattle process is that there's a getting input from everybody is incredibly valuable, and nobody knows how to make a project work for their neighborhood like the people living in it. So it's important to listen to people. I think what bogs down the process, and this is true of any city, is decision making. And, you know, I think what I see here is that there are times when we confuse the achieving consensus with seeking consensus. Seeking consensus is a really laudable goal, and we should always do that, but we should also recognize we will never achieve consensus in a city of 650,000 people.
That's a great point. And if your goal is that everybody's got to agree, then nothing happens.
Question for our chief technologist here, Michael Matt Miller. And Gabe, you talked about it, the importance of kind of information, you know, in transportation futures. I mean, what's happening in Seattle in terms of gathering data and gathering information to make the transportation experience better?
Well, I think, Gabe, you said something very interesting, which is that government is not always great about providing information. But on the flip side, we collect a lot of data, and we generate a lot of data in our operations. And what we did this weekend is we brought people into the process of helping think, how can we use that data to improve transportation? We had what we called Hack the Commute. We brought in 120 developers and user experience designers, and we gave them more than 150 data sets that describe our transportation system. We brought in representatives from King County to provide bus schedules. We brought in representatives from Washington DOT for ferry information. We even had the U.S. Department of Transportation come join us. And it was an absolutely incredible experience. We had people who coded for the upwards of 50 hours in one weekend. These are volunteers who are just passionate about transit. And what they produced were more than 14 ideas. In many cases, they actually worked. They were fully-fledged apps after this weekend. Wow. That could help people make better transportation decisions and really navigate our system in ways they couldn't. Not because the data's not there, but because no one had taken their unique perspective and applied them to our system. One of my favorite examples was called Hackcessible. It was a group of individuals who are passionate about those who have limited mobility. And so they created an app from data the city had that was out on our open data portal, and they allowed individuals to either chart a bus route or a specific address and review the sidewalk conditions in that part of the city, and it gave it kind of the red, yellow, green traffic light score. So an individual who maybe, you know, can't climb a steep incline or perhaps can't navigate a tough sidewalk could get where they were going in a safer manner. So I think those are the types of things that government can be doing and that we're doing in the city with information today.
Okay. And similar to what Gabe was saying, which is if you kind of plan for the vulnerable, you plan for everyone. So a parent with young children, you know, would benefit from that type of app too.
Absolutely.
All right, we have some questions from the audience.
Joanna Cullen, you mentioned that the way you would sell it is to show that it would increase property values and be an investment in the property value. But in Seattle, we're also really having issues with affordability and convincing people that this city is going to be for everyone and that our investments are for everyone.
Do you have a question related to that?
You just wanted to address. I would like you to address that.
Okay. Yeah. It's an issue in every successful city right now. And it's a tough issue. We want integrated cities. We want interesting cultures. We want energy that comes from having different types of people with different occupations and different levels of education, different backgrounds and ethnicities. So it's a real challenge. The more successful we are, the more it's driving people out that have lower incomes. And, you know, I'll let Scott speak to Seattle specifically, but I'll say, you know, nationally, this is a problem that I don't think anybody's got a great answer for, to be completely honest. I think D.C. with the one-third set-aside for lower-income people is great because it integrates people that are lower-income with different backgrounds with people that have more money in the same building. So that, you know, but then, like, I have a friend who got one of those units, and now he makes $300,000 a year. He doesn't speak English that well, but he's become a mortgage broker to the Latino community, and he's part of the 1% now. So it's sort of this weird problem. Like, once people become successful, then what?
I think, to your point on affordability here in Seattle, I think what we really have is a 1-2 punch, right? Of looking at transportation is 17% of the average household's expenditure, so it's the second highest thing after housing. And in November of 14, we passed the transit measure, which is going to provide affordable transportation throughout the city, extend bus hours, make it easier for people to live car-free. And then when you look at the levy that we're proposing, the projects there are all about improving the speed and reliability of transit and making the transit that we're investing in with the Prop 1 in 2014 work even better in 2015 and beyond.
Also raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. I mean, it's like a whole ecosystem of issues that have to work together.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Pure, and I have a PSA and a question. I'm from King County Metro, and we are actually having a long-range plan community visioning workshop in this room on Tuesday at this time, 6 o'clock. And we hope you can bring all of your transit hopes and dreams to that workshop, because it really speaks to a lot of what we're talking about tonight. One of the questions I have is, how can we make our transit and transportation system more family-friendly, looking at all of the different options that we're talking about today? You know, I'm talking everything from getting a stroller on a bus in a dignified manner. You've seen it, people just sort of struggling. To, you know, when folks have kids, they love living in the city in a high rise, and then they have kids, and then the good school is over there, and so they go over there and they get a minivan. So it doesn't always happen, but it does happen. And so, you know, I've been kind of just struggling with that family-friendly nature of all of this. Not all of us can put our 10-month-old on the front of the bike. More of us can, but how do we get there?
So I'm going to put a little pressure on you, if you don't mind me, because your boss buys a lot of buses. And so making our transit system accessible to families starts with King County Metro. And not that I think King County Metro is doing a great job of building a great bus system, but you know, when I look at buses that are designed in the North American market, right, which is where we buy buses from, the buses have very narrow doors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they're designed by guys that live in Winnipeg and don't ride buses in urban areas. I mean, New Flyer, which is where King County Metro buys their buses, is in Winnipeg, not New York City, not in a market where a lot of people ride buses. So I think that's number one.
All right, so you're not angling for a job at New Flyer.
No, I am not. So. Maybe Volvo. I think the other thing is all the services that we're rolling out partnering to roll out. So DriveNow is going to be a free-floating car sharing service that's going to be launching this year in Seattle, just like Car2Go, but they're going to be using cars that have four seats. So suddenly, instead of just being something that somebody without a kid can use, suddenly you can put a car seat in there, you can take your family and live a car-free lifestyle and still have kids.
Well, yeah, and just to build on that, I mean, I think we're going to have to change our view of what transit is, and I'm amazed when I talk to the heads of transit agencies, they don't really think much about autonomous technology, they aren't thinking about smaller vehicles. It's just like the same thing we've been doing, we're going to keep doing it. And I think we will reach a point where people like yourself, who can't even get their stroller on the bus, are going to say, I'm going to do something different. And there's going to be so many options that you will do something different more of the time. So I hope the transit agencies sort of get their act together on that. And then just to chime in on what you were saying, I think participatory government is really important and breaking down these barriers between private and public sector, which I wanted to talk more about. I just didn't really have time. And this sort of us versus them thing, we need more businesses that are focused on the greater good, and we need more government focused on return on investment. And I think if we can bring people together, we can accomplish a lot more. And the public, individuals can play a big role in that with technology.
I just got to say that I'm from Winnipeg and there's nothing wrong with Winnipeg.
Do you work for New Flyer?
He works for SDOT.
Hi, Justin Resnick with Farron Peers. First off, I want to start by saying I'm a former Washington, D.C. resident, frequent visitor to Chicago. So, Gabe, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Scott, too.
And Scott as well. My question is regarding autonomous vehicles and the connection with land use in the urban form that you touched on a little bit towards the end of your talk. One thing we talk about a lot in our company is what to expect, and can we figure out what to expect when autonomous vehicles start to come online. Mm-hmm. And one of my concerns is I think in the urban setting, I think everything you said is absolutely right. Mm-hmm. What I wonder about is, as you mentioned, Seattle is and the Northwest is an urban a rising mega region. So it's mm-hmm. more than just about the city of Seattle mm-hmm. where these autonomous vehicles may work very well. What I worry about is what happens when suddenly the friction of distance decreases a lot. What happens when you can take a nap for 2 hours in your robocar? You can live out in the high Cascades and say, yeah, it's fine. I don't mind colonizing out there because now I can just take a nap in my car the whole time. So in the medium term, what do these innovations mean for urban form?
Well, a couple things. One is, like, if you talk to Elon Musk or some of the car companies, they'll say, oh, we're not anywhere near ready for urban areas. We're ready to do convoys on highways, right? But you got to be careful when you listen to one manufacturer, because they're really sort of touting what they are doing and what they know. You talk to Google, and they're like, yeah, we don't even know anything about that highway market. Like, this is only for the urban market, right? So that's one thing. I mean, I think that in the medium term, you're going to have vehicles that are basically going to do one thing really well, right? And then over time, sort of like Portland, sorry. But like you have the light rail, like if you're a visitor to Portland, they have the light rail and the streetcar. But if you're using it downtown, you don't even really notice the difference. Like it's functioning the same way downtown. So I think the car companies are very focused on long haul, like suburban to city transportation. Like they're thinking about selling people autonomous cars that function well on the highways and they can read books and this, that, and the other thing, or their iPad. And you saw Mercedes maybe has this vehicle that they've set up that way. It's a big vehicle with four seats, like a living room. And then Google's going to have their little pod car. Apple's going to have their little pod car. And they're going to develop services to go with them that are like Uber. And then over time, I think the vehicles will start to look alike, and they'll be multifunctional. But I think there will be this tension between suburban use and urban use. And there'll be big benefits to both, but there are just different challenges in one urban, you already know this. Does that answer the question, or did you have a further?
I guess just a slight follow-up would be, what can we expect for development?
Oh, development. I'm sorry. So I totally missed the question. Okay. Sorry, I'm a little jet-lagged. So That is a fear. I mean, we've talked in the NACTO forum about, you know, are people going to live in their car? Will people buy a car and sort of work in it, sleep in it, live in it? It is possible. I don't know. You know, your first reaction is, well, that's a horrible thing. But I don't know. Is it? Maybe not. You know, let's see how it develops. You know, I don't know all the answers. I think we do have to allow people to figure out how things work best for them and industry before we overregulate it too much. You know, maybe for our less fortunate people, it's not such a bad idea. I don't know.
I would think Michael has some thoughts on this as well, because, you know, when I think about how the future of the economy works and where all the startups are locating and the knowledge economy, which is driving all the growth, it's all mm-hmm. driven by proximity and people wanting to work together, this whole co-working space concept. So people want to be around people.
I think, yeah, it goes back to what you were mm-hmm. saying with the sharing economy. And maybe it's not that you need the car as a status symbol or you need it to have all these features. But as we have a generation that is more mobile, and we have, I always get the stats slightly wrong, 120,000 people moving to Seattle in the next mm-hmm. 20 years, 75% of them are coming for jobs related to the high-tech sector. Mm-hmm. So they have certain expectations of what they can achieve and the ability to be mobile and follow their career path in a way that might facilitate that kind of lifestyle. So I think that's a really interesting concept.
Well, also, Scott made a good point. We were talking before this, and, like, fundamentally, you can only fit so many cars on the road. And if everybody in the suburbs still has a car, but it's autonomous, you're just going to be stuck in traffic anyway. So I think the transportation as a service model is going to become the next big thing, along with the behavioral economics stuff, like urban engines and all that, and sort of paying people to do what the city wants them to do, like ride a bike or walk. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that you can't fit in every presentation, but I think that's coming. I don't think people are going to be buying cars for the most part.
We've got two more questions, and we'll be wrapping up in about 5 minutes.
Hi there. You actually just went over some of the stuff I wanted to ask about, but there was one piece that you didn't cover. And again, it is about the autonomous vehicles. People are really dazzled by the technology and the news stories. I've spent a lot of time thinking about how people will behave, how they will react to this technology when it finally does arrive, or maybe mm-hmm. it's coming this summer. If we make driving safer, easier, more convenient, maybe even cheaper, those are a lot of signals to people that they're going to react to, and mm-hmm. very possibly people are going to be driving a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to understand how you can be, or how we as a profession can be excited about this technology when it seems to be encouraging people to do something that you spent many, many slides saying is really bad for our culture and that we need mm-hmm. to get rid of. Why are you so excited about autonomous vehicles?
Yep. Awesome question. Keep in mind, we'll have autonomous buses, autonomous minibuses. We already have autonomous rail. So it's not really just about cars. But also, I think that we get too focused on the car being bad. I think the car is bad if there's one person in it all the time, right? The car is bad if it's speeding, if the person's distracted, but it's just a number of seats in a vehicle. It's just the size of a vehicle. Is a bus with 57 seats that gets 4 miles to the gallon that's operating at a quarter full really better than a car that has four people in it? It's actually much less efficient. We used to talk about this. It's like transit's dirty little secret. That the bus, if it's not at capacity, is actually not a very efficient thing. But I'm really glad you asked this question, because as you know, policy wonks, transit wonks, transportation wonks, we're going to have to get our heads around transit basically changing dramatically. But I think the only way you'll be able to navigate yourself around a city will be to walk or bike. And I think that's going to be very attractive to people. Not everybody's going to want to be in a pod all the time, you know?
And I think going along with that, a lot of advances in technology are about reducing friction to accomplish tasks. And so for someone who wants to drive and will always drive, maybe they will get that same satisfaction and find a driverless car easier. For myself, I can't stand driving. I wouldn't want to be in a pod all my time, even if I could sit there on my phone and use it. You know, on the flip side, I don't want to throw him under the bus, my husband, who works one block from a major express bus stop, and we live one block from that same bus line, we'll never take the bus because it's that friction concept. He always has this perception that it's too crowded or the time's not going to work. So if we can also use technology to improve the information availability about, can I fit on that bus? When should I take the bus? Do we start to shift where people find value and help them make better transportation decisions across modes? So I think there's work in what we can also affect outside of that driverless car.
But this is also why it's really important that people know what's going on and are involved, and why NACTO, I think, is it's really important. NACTO is taking a leading role to bring all the cities together so we don't get Ubered, you know? So that we talk to Google, we talk to the car companies, we just had a meeting with NHTSA the other day. We learn, we educate ourselves on what's going on, and we come together and have a policy for all the NACTO, all 39 NACTO cities, so that we can say, well, we don't want these cars to be sold to individuals if possible. We'd like them to be in fleets. I mean, that's a big change, you know? So here's, I guess, what I would say. The technology's coming. The question is, do we shape the change, or do you let the big corporations shape the change? And I'd like to think that we have a lot of say, and the big corporations actually want our help. They want the government's help. There's just not always a good relationship. So we're trying to facilitate that, and I think we'll end up with a better outcome, I hope.
Equality was mentioned throughout the presentation. If cost of living continues the present trend in urban areas, and the sharing economy requires a smartphone and data plan buy-in, how will economic segregation be prevented? Relatedly, in a state like Illinois, where suburban municipal budgets are threatened, how are change agents to sell these new investments, changing the very foundation of suburbs?
Go ahead.
So it's a great question and very timely here in the city of Seattle. We in the city produce a report every 4 years called the Technology Indicators Report. And what we use this for is to understand who has access to technology, where we have gaps in our society, and how that helps inform how we deliver city services. In the most recent report that came out in May of last year, we learned that in the lowest quintile of income here in the city, you only have a 49% chance of having internet access at home. Yet your 65% chance of having a smartphone or a Wi-Fi capable device. Now, what we've learned through focus groups and other anecdotal feedback is, even though you have that smartphone device, you may not have a data plan, to your point. So how do you interact with technologies that help you navigate our transportation system? I'm just curious, who in this room uses One Bus Away on a daily basis?
Wow.
So that awesome. Does make life, it's great, but it certainly is something that as we think about expanding our transportation service, how do we reach those audiences? And there has been some great things done in the city, like you see the kiosks downtown, but that's not a complete solution. And somewhat orthogonal to transportation, we're kicking off an initiative in the city to think about digital equity and how we do ensure all of those people can use the most current technology tools we all benefit from. But we do need to continue thinking about alternatives for those who aren't using those apps today.
I just want to add in a little thing to address a little bit different part of your question, and that is that our economy is structurally going to shift so much that, you know, there are estimates that 53% of jobs will disappear over the next 20 years, period. And again, we don't have time to get into all of that and why, but just autonomous cars, you know, 4 to 5 million jobs go away, like, in a blink. Yeah, now they can't hire enough truckers for the truck industry, so maybe it's not so bad. People actually don't want to drive trucks anymore, right? But there are issues. Like, technology, specifically automation, is going to dramatically affect our daily lives and what we do. And I don't think that we will define ourselves in the future based on how much time we work. But there's a lot of complicated things that are going to have to be worked out. But it's a bigger issue.
And I was going to say, I think, just to address your issue, you know, if you look at the Gini coefficient, right, we're an unequal society, and probably more so at any time than over the last 100 years or so. But when you look at the transportation investments that we're prioritizing and the choices we're trying to give people, walking is a pretty affordable way to get around, and that's really what we're trying to do with our city, is make it as walkable as possible. Biking, also very affordable to get around. Mm-hmm. If you actually join Pronto, and if we had a larger system, it would be even more true. For $85 a year, you can get anywhere you want in the city. You'll actually save $85 in shoe costs, right? So that is actually probably the cheapest way to get around. But walking, biking, taking transit, incredibly affordable, and that's why we're investing in them.
Also, why are jobs going away? Because so many things are going to be free. Internet will be free at some point. Energy will be free. When we get on renewables, yeah, not if Comcast has anything to say about it. But when solar panels get so efficient that you can really power everything yourself, and by the way, the utilities are completely freaked out about this. When a critical mass of things in our lives become free, it's just going to change everything because the people that used to do those jobs. So you're not going to need as much money, but those jobs go away too.
So huge economic shifts on the horizon, equity issues to deal with, affordability issues, and also selling people on the vision so that they will get out of their cars. A lot of stuff.
Thanks
Scott.
So much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It helps other listeners find us. The Seattle Department of Transportation, the Office of Arts and Culture, and KUOW are partnering on this series of talks with transportation experts. Where Are We Going? Seattle's Transportation Future. Gabe Klein spoke at the Seattle Public Library Central Library on March 25th, 2015. Thanks again to Kevin Mitchum for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.